Welcome to the Black History Short Stories Podcast. I am your host, Amandre Johnson. Glad to have you here in season two. On this podcast, we discuss short stories from Black history with a person who has an invested interest in Black history. Here, we think it's important to carry on the stories of our past and most of all, continue the legacies and memories that are important to our future. Here today, we have Shawanda. Please tell us your birth year and where you were born.
Hey, so I was born in 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Outstanding. Shawanda is a fellow teacher, and she teaches elementary school, and she is an amazing teacher. She does an amazing job, and I was fortunate enough to be able to be a student teacher in her class when I was in my master's classes at Virginia Tech. So I'm so glad to have her here and have her a part of this podcast.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Today, we're going to talk about Dr. Valerie Thomas. She's a scientist. She worked for NASA. She is an amazing woman, HBCU grad. And I just love her as a person. She's still alive. I would love to be able to meet her and talk with her. She did some amazing things. When I was going through this research, a lot of the stuff that she was talking about is over my head. So I know you are, you know, you do math and you do science and her specialties in like physics and stuff. So maybe you can help me piece some of this together.
Well, you know, I teach third grade math, so We'll try to figure it out together.
And that's the best thing about elementary school is I've always learned that, you know, we can figure it out. So Valerie Thomas was born February 1943 in Maryland. And I did a lot of research in this and I couldn't find the exact city where she was born. And I don't know if that has to do with her still being alive or like respecting her privacy and whatnot, or if there's just not enough research being done. But
if she was born in 1943, it seemed like there should be some more out there.
I agree. But and maybe it's just me not digging as hard as I can. But I do try hard and I couldn't find it. But that's okay, because, you know, we'll get there. At a very young age, she attended an all-girls school. And at that young age, you know, we're talking K through fifth grade, she was not encouraged to pursue science and math courses, although she did manage to land herself in a physics course, which was a big part of her life. Going through age eight, she once, a story tells that she checked out a book called The Boy's First Book on Electronics, and that was from the local library. And this right here really got her interest going because her father also worked with electronics, although he refused to work with her on any of the projects from the book. So, and it didn't give like great detail on that. And I couldn't find like any quotes from her on that. That's just something that she has passed on from her past specifically.
But look at the title.
I know, right?
You know, and girls were expected to be nurses or teachers.
You know, we talked about another woman before, Charlotte E. Ray. Have you heard of her?
I have not. I'm writing her name down now, though.
She's a first Black lawyer, first Black female lawyer. And her schooling through college was through teaching. The only reason she got into law school is because she signed her name C.E. Ray to disguise it so it could be male or female. And when she showed up, they were like, wait a minute. But she's already.
I wonder what year that was, too.
Oh, this is a long time ago. I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but it's 1800s.
Oh, wow.
That's a long time ago. So she ended up going, she still went to an all-girls high school, and they did not push her to take advanced science or math, no matter how much she loved it, no matter how much she read about it. They just didn't encourage her in that direction. But again, even from that book when she was eight, her curiosity was piqued. So when she got out of high school, she set out on the path to become a scientist. So she enrolled in Morgan State University, you know, great HBCU in Maryland. And she performed exceedingly well as a student. She graduated with a degree in physics and she was one of only two women in her class to do so. Following her degree, she accepted a position with NASA, which, for those who don't know, the Nautical Aeronautics and Space Administration, and she was a data analyst. So she started as data analysis, but then she grew to be, you know, a really important person and a bigger role at NASA in the 70s. And this is, I think, this is kind of like, you know, talked about and then moved on. But I feel like we got to sit here for a minute and talk about this. In 1970s, okay, she managed the development of the image processing systems for Landsat. If you never heard of Landsat, Landsat 1 was the first satellite to send images to the Earth from space.
Wow, the first.
The first. Like, we got to sit and marinate in that, because, you know, the articles I've read, all of them mention this, but then it moves on to her patent and her inventions. But this being a part of this, you know, development.
But the groundwork, you know, that they had to come and, you know, just the disrespect that would have come with people overlooking her, people thinking that she was the help. Like, what are you doing in NASA? What are you doing, you know, in here? You know, this trash can needs emptying. And here she is, like, you know, developing the first of, you know, what we have been using till today.
Absolutely. So, like, I can't imagine the joy, the excitement of seeing that first image and knowing that you were part of making that happen. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, the Earth's first selfie.
Yes, and I hope she was like, I told you so.
I hope she
about this life.
Oh, I hope she let them have it and let them know that she had arrived. And they got that first image on July 23rd, 1972. And I really, like, when I read this and I went back and, you know, I read a couple articles, I read them a couple times, like, why are we not sitting on this and talking about this a little bit more? Because this is an amazing achievement. And
think about, you know, 1970, I know there are school districts around this area where I live now who didn't integrate until the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
So this is pre-integration.
Oh, yeah. In thinking another way, because, you know, I coach and whatnot, she did this. She helped out and was on this team that got the world's first selfie in 1972. That's the same year that the last college football team in America integrated.
Wow.
That's the same year Ole Miss had its first black football player.
Lord, Ole Miss. I don't even want to talk about Ole Miss.
Talk about, I mean, I it's just amazing.
They finally got that flag down, so.
They did. They did.
I'm not happy about that.
Yeah. Small victories, but victories.
Yeah, nonetheless. You know, I wanted to say something, too, when you're talking about how she read the book, she was interested, and her father just kind of, everybody just kind of wrote it off, like, you know, go play with a doll or something. Mm-hmm. My granddad was born in 1935 and had his own business for many years. And so when the boys in my family came of age, they would all go work. It was contracting. So they were laying, you know, brick and doing roofing and, you know, all these different things. And I remember when I got old enough, I begged my granddaddy, please let me work, because I wanted some money. Uh-huh. Let me work. And he wrote me off. And, you know, now that he's aged out of his business and none of the boys kept the business going. And I thought about it very recently. I thought I could have kept that business going. I could have kept our family business alive had he let me learn the ropes. But I was, you know, because I was a girl, I was never allowed to learn and go on job sites.
You think that he doesn't believe that that was your place to do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, my grandparents were married for over 60 years. My grandma took care of the home. She worked outside the home, but she took care of everything within the home, children, you know, and all included. She never learned to drive. Mm. So she depended on my granddad to do all of the other things. And so I think that, and my granddaddy got five daughters, and you know, I don't know how many granddaughters, but taught any of us.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Huh. Interesting. See, that's a different perspective, because I don't know. I had a different type of upbringing. We'll talk about that. We'll come back.
Okay.
In 1976, she went to this science exhibit, and I'm gonna do my best to explain this. So follow me.
I'm following.
So at this science exhibit, this is that moment to where she says, "I'm gonna do this." So she goes to the science exhibit and she sees an illusion of a glowing light bulb that had been unscrewed and removed from a lamp. So the exhibit used concave mirrors to trick the person looking at it into believing that the light bulb was glowing even after it had been unscrewed from its socket. And unlike flat mirrors, which produce images that appear to be inside or behind the mirror, concave mirrors create images that appear to be real or in front of the mirror itself. So when I read that, first of all, I'm not ashamed to say it, I had to read that about six times. After I read it, I still couldn't picture in my mind what was going on. So I had to do further research and I had to find images.
And okay.
The images, still didn't get it. So I had to go to YouTube and try to find, like I said, I have to know what this is talking about. From reading that, do you have a picture in your mind of what this looks like?
I do have a picture in my mind. So I might be wet. You want me to tell you?
Tell me and then I'll explain. I might have to explain it.
Way, way off. So I'm thinking of a lamp or some kind of light source. Wow. Concave would mean that it's kind of indented, maybe, like almost like corners. So then the one light is reflecting off the other light. The light is reflecting on the mirror, and then the mirror is throwing it across to the other mirror, so it gives the illusion of it still glowing. That's in my head.
Okay. I think you're right. So I came up with this. I thought about this a bunch on how would be the most simplest way to explain it. So I'm gonna do my best, but I think what you said is right. So picture a box, okay? And there is a light bulb on top of that box.
Okay.
All right, that box sits in front of a concave mirror, which means it does have that, like it's got that dent in it, that middle was kind of
circular. Okay.
The mirror that I saw in the image was circular. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, concave, so it's got, you know, indented in. All right, and there's a button that turns that light bulb on. So the person at this exhibit lets you press the button and turn the light bulb on. Mm-hmm. So the person would then unscrew that light bulb, then ask you to press the button again, and you would see that the light was still there. The illusion was that the light was still on. Now, this is because on the other side of that box that you can't see, there is another light up under it that's upside down. So there's a light bulb on top and a light bulb underneath that you can't see. Now, what the concave mirror does, the concave mirror reflects things in reverse. It will reflect that light that's upside down right side up. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't be able to tell when that light bulb is in the, it was in on top. But once you unscrew it and you press the button, that image would still be there because of that concave mirror.
Okay.
And that was the illusion. And this was, you know, when I saw this, I was like, whoa, you know, David Blaine type magic.
Yeah.
I was astounded. So the deal with concave mirrors, the difference between a flat mirror and a concave mirror is a flat mirror reflects back at you. A concave mirror will reflect it opposite, upside down, per se. So if you can go on YouTube and type in concave mirror experiments, and you'll see one with a big concave mirror and a guy with a rope and a ball. And he kind of lets the ball go towards the mirror. And it's trippy on as it gets closer to the mirror, it flips upside down and then moves away and gets right back side up. So this was
so it almost works like a periscope. And I say that because my when my boys were little, I used to take them to Lowe's or Home Depot, and on Saturday mornings they would make something from a wood box or a birdhouse, something like that. And I have it in my classroom now. One time they made it's a rectangular prism. And at each end, there are two concave mirrors. So there's one and they go different ways. So when you look at the bottom of one, you look in the mirror, it'll show you what's going on out there, even though there's no window in front of it. I'll take a picture of it when I get to my classroom tomorrow and send it to you so you can see how it kind of works. So I can picture that.
Yeah, you know, I never thought about a periscope.
Concave is not standing straight up. It's, yeah. And so it works as a periscope, being that you can, you know, duck down and look, and then you just have this box, this image, like how, like on a satellite. I mean, not a satellite, but a submarine.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, you know more than I do. I have no idea how a periscope or a submarine works. But that right there was, you know, when I watched the video, I was astounded.
Okay. So she saw this in 1976.
She saw this in 1976 and was like, whoa. She's like, you know, this is something here that I could work with. So in 1977, she began experimenting with flat mirrors and concave mirrors, you know. And just another description, flat mirrors provide a reflection of an object which appear to lie behind the glass surface. A concave mirror presents a reflection that appears to exist in front of the glass, thereby providing the illusion that they exist in a three-dimensional manner.
Okay.
Thomas believes that images presented in this way could provide a more accurate, if not more interesting, manner of representing video data. She not only viewed the process as potential breakthrough for commercial television, but also as a scientific tool for NASA and its image delivery system. And I thought this was amazing because me personally, I don't know if I've ever had that moment to where I see something and I know I can take this and I can run with it and I can improve on it and I can change things with this. And
I was thinking the same thing. Like, how do you get that? How do you see this light and then go there? Like, oh yeah, we can take this into space. We can take this, you know, and make it into basically, because it's what we're doing today.
Oh yeah.
You know, has morphed from that illusion that she saw in 1976. So yeah, I've never been that creative.
Yeah.
I would just been flipping a switch on and off, like, oh, that's fun. Oh,
I'd have been amazed and just told all my friends about it. But she, like I said, that's a working mind, because she saw this and boom, she knew that this is,
yeah,
this person. And none of the articles I read about talked about the person who had the exhibit, but when she saw it, I imagine her mind was, this person doesn't know what they have. Like, because she
right. Picked it up and that, yeah, yeah, and I bet they didn't.
So what she did is she took this and she created what's called an illusion transmitter. So we'll talk about her patent for a second. She applied for a patent. Okay. For her process on December 28, 1978. The patent was issued on October 21st, 1980. So this is a 2-year process. Try to describe it the best I can here from the articles that I read. The invention was similar to the technique of holographic production of image recording, which uses coherent radiation and employs front wave reconstruction techniques, which render the process unfeasible due to the enormous expense and complicated setup. To put that in terms that I understand, it's saying that,
I was gonna say, I might need a dictionary.
Listen now, when I read through this, that's why I said a lot of this is over my head. What it means is she created what would be called almost holographic images. And it's a little bit different than holographic images, because holographic images require a very complicated setup and is super expensive to do. So she created this technique to give a similar image without having that cost and setup. you know, she did it with mirrors.
And yeah,
I don't even know the science to talk about, you know, holographic images and how that works with,
I'm right.
with some lasers or something in there. So, this
wow. is
talk about, you know, parabolic mirrors, and they can render these optical illusion with the use of a concave mirror near the subject image and a second concave mirror at a remote site. In the description of her patent, the process is explained. The mirror creates 3D images and is still used by NASA, surgery, and TV today. So, which she was able to put together with these concave mirrors and a parabolic mirror is she was able to create a 3D image that could be filmed and sent off from, you know, anywhere. You could create a 3D image from anywhere and then record it, and it could be sent out through TV. NASA still uses it today, and surgery still use it. And I couldn't find how they use it in surgery and in medicine, but I can only imagine the ability you could have to, you know, to do surgery with a concave mirror and see that image in front of you rather than having to, you know, I imagine my first thought was like open heart surgery. If you can have a concave mirror to present that image of that heart in front of you, rather than having to look down and focus on everything around it, you know, that's a game changer.
Well, I watch those shows where people get like a laparoscopic surgery or something like that. Uh-huh. And you see how they, you know, take these rods and they go in, and then it's projected, the image of what they're doing is projected on the screen. And I wonder if that's what and even with open heart surgery, they're in there. They don't see what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're not looking down in it. They are using the cameras to go in to uh-huh. shoot, and then it's positioned on the screen overhead, and they can look up and figure out where they're, where they need to be, where they are and where they need to be and what needs to be done. So I don't know, but that's what came to my mind.
I don't know either. This is, again, she's way smarter than I'll ever be.
It's amazing. And she's young too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I do want to read. I feel like it's important to read the abstract of her patent.
Okay.
So, you know, for all our listeners out there who are, you know, really interested in this and who are going to take this and further their research, I'll read the abstract from her patent. It says, a real-time illusion transmitter for transmitting three-dimensional illusions of an object comprising a first parabolic mirror for producing a real image of an illuminated object. Image detection means disposed in a position to receive said real image and adapt it to generate video signals for transmission by cable or electromagnetic means. A second parabolic mirror located at a remote site and having associated therewith an image projector for producing an image from signals transmitted from said first parabolic mirror, said image projector projecting an image normal to the principal axis of the parabolic mirror to produce an illusion of the image when reflected from the parabolic mirror.
Man, you lost me at time.
Look, now. I would love for her to sit down and explain this to me word by word. I was like, when I read the abstract, I said, yeah, I'll read this, but this doesn't help me any. Like, I had to.
It really, I mean, you have to go through it like sentence by sentence and take apart the words and like find the Greek meaning of them.
Yes. When you look at the picture, and what I'll do is I'll post a picture of this invention on Short Stories of Black History Twitter page. Mm-hmm. It kind of starts making a little bit more sense. When you can see the image, it kind of starts making a little bit more sense because it shows you the mirror. It shows you, you know, when they talk about an image projector, that just means camera. So
yeah,
it shows you the camera and how it works, and it's got arrows to say where it starts and where the image goes, and you know. So that made a little bit more sense. Now, the science behind this is, again, still beyond me.
Yeah, I mean, think about, like, I go back to 8-year-old her, and all of this was locked in, the tiny little brain.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's, you know, to be able, and I, you know, because it doesn't go into detail, but it, you know, they talk about how she read the book and that she was interested at that time, but I can imagine she was building all kind of stuff, taking things apart, like in the house, you know, taking things apart, rewire, you know, she was doing all of these things that as a child, I wonder that, you know, we probably would never hear about.
Mm-hmm.
This, that right there that you just read, that doesn't come from, that doesn't just come from nothing. Like, that's in there.
I agree. I agree. And I'm sure she was working. There's a, another woman who we're going to do a later podcast on. And in her childhood, she invented and expanded on many different things. And, you know, it wasn't something that was well advertised because, like you said earlier, they're kind of like, yeah, sure, that's great. You know, but, mm-hmm. you know, there are other things that they believe women should do.
Right.
And, but it's, yeah, I agree. It takes a mind now, a great mind to think of this. And after her invention, she continued to work for NASA. She retired in 1995. During that time that she worked for NASA, she held a number of positions, including project manager of Space Physics Analysis Network and associate chief of the Space Science Data Operations Office. She also received a number of awards while she worked at NASA, including the Goddard Space Flight Center Award of Merit and NASA Equal Opportunity Medal. Her success was amazing. You know, despite her lack of early support, you know, her interest and her ambition and her drive took her to reach these amazing goals. And she continues to this day, as far as I know, to continue these things. And as she didn't feel like she received the support as a child, she now gives out that support to children. She mentored youths through the National Technical Association in Science, Mathematics, Aerospace Research, and Technology program. She is still alive. She's an article quoted saying, like, she's alive, well, and fine. One of the things I loved about her is when, you know, you go through her pictures or you Google her. She's a beautiful woman.
Yep.
She has amazing hair. And while she's at NASA, she wore this huge afro, all her natural hair, this huge afro. And I love that.
And I mean, even today, they're having bills signed where they are now allowing us to wear our hair in which it grows from our head and in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I mean, she was busting moves in NASA in the 70s.
With the fro.
Kudos to her.
With the fist. With
they
the fist.
Not her, they couldn't deny her talent, though.
No, you can't.
Creating things like that. You know what I'm surprised, though, and I not necessarily surprised, but I wonder what she didn't receive credit for.
Mm.
There were a lot of small things that she did and did not receive credit for. I mean, she probably had, I was surprised that it took, what, 2 years to get the patent? I'm like, just 2 years for a Black woman? I mean, gosh, you know?
I agree. I'm sure that there's other things in there that we could definitely expand on and definitely haven't came out yet. But
you know, does she have a book?
Not that I found, not that I read.
Okay.
I don't know. I have to do more research to find out. Not
you have to get, yeah, I mean, and what better person to write it, you know, for?
Indeed. Indeed. What we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break and you'll hear from our sponsors. Welcome back to Short Stories of Black History. I want to take time to give a quick shout out to the Perlow Podcast Network that helped me start this podcast. We're going to talk about Dr. Ty and the Colonel, who recently did a live cast of Tremors, one of the classics with Kevin Bacon. And also the Perlow Podcast that did his top 10 list. And this week's top 10 list was on their on top Nickelodeon shows. And me and Shawana was talking about her top Nickelodeon show. And you said it was what?
SpongeBob.
And I would probably see, I'm a little bit more older. I miss the days of Are You Afraid of the Dark? And I miss Doug. I miss Rugrats. So
I love Rugrats, and I like Doug. Was Hey Arnold on Nickelodeon?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
I liked Hey Arnold too. You know what? Though SpongeBob has adult humor.
It does. It does.
So
I agree.
You know, so we can laugh with the kids as we watch it now.
You know what? I never thought about that.
Yeah,
you're right. But if you want to know if your favorite Nickelodeon show made the top 10 list, you have to listen to the Perlow podcast to find out. I also want to give a shout out to Danielle Moneyham, who does the podcast Black Educators Matter, and her goal is to interview 500 Black educators, and she does an amazing job. And she's an amazing person, so please go check those out. But now we're on to our favorite part of the podcast, our questions, where we get to learn more about our guests. So what was your best subjects in school? And why did you feel they were your best subjects?
Oh, gosh. My best, that means that I excelled in.
I guess you could consider it.
I was like.
Which one you had most fun in, I guess.
Is PE a choice?
As always, it's yours.
Oh, gosh. I hate when my students say, you know, we did all these awesome lessons throughout the year. And what was your favorite subject? Oh, PE. I'm like, I would say history. I didn't know it then, but I appreciate it now. And I learned more even back then than I realized. So I picked up on a lot. So, and it's still my favorite.
Okay. So why do you feel like it was your best subject? Is it something that sat with you, or is it something that you found interesting?
I have a hard time with things that are abstract.
Okay.
So although you have your time and your date, like these things really did happen, there's probably a picture of it somewhere, or I can draw in my mind a picture of it, what happened, and make my, you know, the event and wrap my head around it. I think being from Greensboro, so rich in history, that, you know, if I learned something in school, like the Woolworth, where the Woolworth 4, like I used to shop there. I used to eat there. So those things I can wrap my head around those.
I definitely understand that. Cause you know, if you haven't been able to, well, listeners haven't been able to tell by the podcast, you know, I love history myself. And, you know, I can recall me at a young age watching the History Channel, watching Storage Wars, watching Pawn Stars, but stuff like that, because they bring in these old items and you get to see old things, you get to visit these places and, you know, what those things have seen and the hands that those things have touched and the places that those items have been is also interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. And I want to know more about that. And also.
And then you want to visit those places.
I do. I love museums. I do. I love museums.
Me too. You know, when I retire from teaching or win the lottery, I'm going to be a museum tour guide.
That sounds
like a dream job.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing job. I would definitely love that. One of the things that I've learned history for that fact. And then when I got to college, I started to like history for like another reason, because of the different interpretations of same events.
Yes.
And that really was like, wow, there's so many different ways to view this.
Depending on the storyteller.
Exactly. And that's what really got me going, because I want to know about all the storytellers. I want to know about, you know, everything that everybody says about, you know, certain situations.
You know what got me was learning world history.
Mm-hmm.
And from the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
And having a professor say, oh, yeah, that's Jerusalem. That's the story that's in the Bible. And putting that together, like, wait a minute. When I teach my students, my third graders, about the first Olympics, I talk to them about, oh, yeah, like, I try to make them picture it. I'll say something like, oh, that was in baby Jesus time. Like, they go, we go way back to baby Jesus, you know, kind of thing. And so they can say, oh, wow, that was not like, because, you know, they'll be like, were you there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Olympics, you know? So I'm like, well, no, this baby Jesus we talking about, you know? So they can relate, like, okay, this was, you know, like 2 years older than she, you know?
That's a good idea. I need to use that one.
Yeah, baby Jesus.
Yeah, I always use, like, kind of the Columbus thought theory that, you know, from where Columbus came from, he was a great explorer who did amazing things and brought back all this stuff. To the Native Americans, Columbus was a terrible person.
He was
the devil to him. To
them. And he died of VD.
I did not know that, did he?
Yes, he did. And I come close to telling my students every year, but then I don't want to have to explain what VD is. So so I leave that part out. But I wrote a whole rap about Christopher Columbus, and because they made me teach it. So I was like, well, if I'm going to teach it, I'm going to teach it like I want to. I'm going to put the facts in there as listed in the book. However, I need to let you know that, you know, have you ever heard my Christopher Columbus rap?
I have not. I'm interested in that.
I'm not going to play like the audio and all that, but it says Christopher Columbus sailed from Spain. Some call him a genius, but that's insane. He was looking for Asia, but decided to go west. Tried to take the shortcut. He thought it was the best. Instead of finding America, America found him. Natives already there, so he called them Indians. San Salvador is where he sailed and died, never made it to Asia, but man, he tried.
Wow.
That's my rap.
I love that. I had to teach about, you know, Columbus too, and my kids prior to that, you know, they knew Christopher Columbus and thought he was somebody.
1492.
Yeah. We had to talk about, you know, guys, you can't discover a place where people are already at.
Yeah. And he never made it to where he wanted to go.
Right. And I said,
good idea.
It was like, wasn't he good at sailing? Well, you know, he kind of didn't go where he needed to, where you thought he was going.
Yeah.
So I don't know how great of a sailor he was.
Mm-hmm. And never made it to mainland. I mean, he was like Bermuda, something. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they didn't know what they were doing.
Those things. We can talk about that. I love that.
Love history. I love history.
So big question here. How can you thank Black women more for their contribution?
How can we thank Black women more?
For their contribution, yes.
Support them. Mm-hmm. Just stand behind them. You take somebody like Dr. Valerie Thomas, who at 8 years old said, I have this great idea, and, you know, listen to her, you know, make her feel empowered. And I think by listening to her and saying, you know, that's a great idea, let's go build this, you know, 8 year old genius, you know, it may not look like much at eight, but, you know, they have something in there that needs to be nurtured. So definitely nurturing our girls and, you know, from young on up.
I agree. I definitely agree. One of the things that, you know, we do in our classroom, you know, at second grade, you know, I tell everybody, specifically, you know, the young girls in my class, when they'll ask me to do something for them that they can do, and I'll tell them, no, you are a strong, independent young lady. You can
it
gets me because they'll repeat that to their peers, you know.
When they are questioning their abilities.
Well, absolutely. They'll tell others, they'll be like, hey, can you, or they're crying, or like so-and-so
pushed me.
You are a strong, independent young woman. You got this. And, you know, I love that. And I am
totally going to use that.
I encourage them as much as I can.
Absolutely. And representation matters.
Indeed, it does.
Representation matters. I do what I do because I have to represent.
Absolutely. I always say the teachers, you know, are the heroes that you can see and talk to every day. You know, the kids in my class, you know, of course they're going to love LeBron James. They're going to love Beyonce. They're going to love Obama. And I want to be that hero to them that they can high mm-hmm. five, that they can shake hands yeah. with, you know, that they can hug every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's interesting is growing up, is I didn't love the LeBron James and I didn't love the Oprah because I couldn't touch them. They weren't real to me. They were fantasy. So I was looking for people in my family to be that for me. And of course, with my situation, I couldn't find anybody. So I developed at a young age that I'm going to be her. I'm going to be her so that there's somebody they can touch and inspire to be like until, you know, get to this level and then shoot for Oprah, shoot for, you know, Michelle Obama, you know, but like, and they need something tangible.
I agree.
As opposed to abstract.
I agree.
I struggle with abstract. I do. I really do. That's why, like I was telling you earlier, like I'm all about nonfiction because I've never read a Harry Potter book. Don't judge me. But I cannot do fantasy. I cannot let my brain go there.
I've never read a Harry Potter book, but maybe
we might get stoned for saying something like that.
Not reading a Harry Potter book?
Yes.
I'm not saying this is bad.
No, people love their Harry Potter and I can't get into it.
Unpopular opinion, I also haven't seen Star Wars.
Same.
My
kids love, they never got into the Harry Potter, but Star Wars, the Clone Wars, and I mean, we still have action figures around here from Star Wars. So,
ironically, Star Wars, there is I don't know if it's fact or not, because again, I've never seen the movie, but like, it's kind of based on Nazi Germany and World War II time. Mm. So I've never seen it, so I don't know the relationship. That's just something that I've heard and I've read it mm-hmm. the whole time.
And you know, I think in saying all of that, I think another thing is that I love history. Like the books that I choose to read, I already know how they end.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
So I know how history played out.
Right.
So that's why I gravitate to it, I guess. I mean, I'm just kind of speculating. I've never put too much thought into it, but. Okay. You know,
I'm gonna add a question here at the end. We'll go back. Did you or do you ever feel limited in what you can achieve? And why or why not?
I don't.
Okay.
I used to. Feel limited because I did not have support growing up, I would say. But the goals that I have set for myself, even from childhood, and it took me to become an adult or to get to a place where I was more independent. The goals that I set, I've conquered them. And so, you know, I'll conquer it and I'll sit in it. Wait in it for a little bit and then I'll set another goal.
Indeed.
Don't feel limited. I know that what I, you know, put my mind to do, I can do it. And I know that now because I've done it already.
Indeed. Good. I can say that I can agree with you, me being younger, I can say that I felt limited. I can always remember definitely, you know, a lot of people around me, you know, adults around me and other of my peers saying things like, I'm just not good at math, or I'm just not good at science. Mm-hmm. And I took that as, you know, there's some things that you just can't do. But as I've grown, I know that that's not true. When I took my master's classes, and this is up until college, not too long ago, you know, I told my teacher who did math, who taught me how to teach math, I said, you know, I've never really been good at math. And she looked at me and said, you just never had the right teacher because everybody can be good at math. I said, okay. You know, you know, I was skeptical. I said, knock yourself out, lady.
Yeah. You know what? You have to ask for help.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my thing. I got so frustrated. I mean, trying to learn this online platform, I was so frustrated. I'm on computers last week. I was done. I'm like, is Arby still hiring? I mean, I was done. But I had to scream out for help. I said, you know, Monday, and I talked to my husband and said, as soon as I walk in the door Monday, I'm going to say, like, stop what you're doing because I need some help with this. So, and I got the help and now I feel confident in it, but I tried to figure it out myself and I was struggling. So it's okay to ask for help to get over that hump.
I agree. And the big thing that I learned is like you said, I did ask for help. I said, ma'am, I don't understand this. She said, okay, you know, we'll sit after class. She had student interns mm-hmm. who helped me. And the biggest thing that I've learned is, like, I've always took math as specifically math as there's one way to do things.
Yes.
And when she sat me down and was like, how would you figure this out? My first thought was, ain't this your job to tell me how to figure it out? Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, how would you figure this out? And we talked about, you know, all the different strategies and all the things we could try. And mm-hmm. you know, coming to realize that it's not that I wasn't good at it, just my way wasn't the way I was taught. So I thought I was bad at it.
Okay.
And, you know, when I realized that there are different strategies to use, yeah. you know, that's a game changer. So, you know, I definitely do that mm-hmm. you know, with my students, you know.
Yeah.
Students come up with different ways to do things and we get to that.
Being what some people call a veteran teacher, I don't feel seasoned at all, but being
years is for you.
I get called that from time to time. So I, you know, we were taught one way. So, and then when I, you know, the district that I work for, they said, teach it this way. Mm. I'm like, nope, this is where you have to do it. In the last maybe 4 years, I've decided that, you know what, I don't care how you get the answer. I don't care what resources you have to use, fingers, toes. Like, if you can arrive at the answer, I support that.
I agree. And so,
but I've had to really train. And I said veteran teacher because, you know, I'm like, this is the way it's supposed to be done. And you're not doing it right. But that's no wrong.
I agree.
If you can arrive at the desired answer.
I agree. How long have you been teaching? What year is this for you?
I get mixed up, but I think it's my 14th year.
You're better. Yeah. You're a veteran teacher.
That's what they say, but.
I will say this, you know, talk about how you get to an answer. And I've only been teaching 3 years. One of my favorite moments is, you know, I'm sitting there with a kid and a parent talking, and the kid asked the parent a question. I don't remember what it was about, but the kid said, look it up on Google. And I was like, oh my gosh, because that's something we do in class when kids ask me mm-hmm. questions. They'll ask me questions about space and I'll tell them, I don't know, let's figure it out. And we'll look it up right there. Mm-hmm. And that's the world they're going to grow up in. That's the world they're going to live in. That information is accessible to them at all times.
The day and age where, oh, you're not going to have a calculator everywhere you go. Mm.
Those days are gone. Yeah, information is accessible to you at all times. And they know that. And they know that they don't have to wait on an answer. They can find this, like, show me, I can read this now. And I really love that. That was a big impact on me. I was like, wow.
I have my phone with me everywhere I go. And I have to explain to people sometimes that when something pops in my head, I have to find out the answer. So it's not that I'm ignoring you or I'm just on the phone, you know, surfing for something. I am looking, something popped in my head and I need to know the answer like right away.
Absolutely.
And so I researched it. I mean, people will say, you know, isn't this person related to this person? Let me find out, you know, in terms of like public figures, you know, how do you do this? I don't know, but let's look.
I agree.
I did have an Alexa Echo Dot in my classroom one time. I had to take her home. But, you know, like I would say, go Alexa, you know, like go over there, have a conversation with her, figure it out, come back and let us know.
I love that. I love that. Huh. So, regarding Black history, what do you consider to be the most significant event in your lifetime?
Of my lifetime?
Yes, ma'am.
In Black history, wow. I've never even thought of that.
Everybody has to answer this question on the podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay. How much time do we have?
Well, take your time. Think about it.
Oh, gosh.
You want to come back to it?
I don't want to be cliche, but
Obama.
Yes.
I don't think it's cliche. I think it's monumental.
Yes.
I think it's perfectly acceptable. My aunt was on here, and she's almost 70 years old, and she talked about Obama. Is that
it? Not something I ever thought would happen. I never. And I, you know, like, and we didn't, and I say we, not necessarily me, but the generation before me didn't encourage Black kids to try and be a president. I mean, it was not even heard of. So I feel like that was the biggest.
And that's perfectly fine. Several people have said that on the mm-hmm. podcast. And it, like I said, I don't think it's cliche. I think it's a monumental mm-hmm. moment.
I'm trying to think of more, I probably will think of more that compare, but yeah.
I also think it depends on like your experiences, you know, through mm-hmm. life too.
Absolutely.
And you know, what helps shape you and shape your decisions, mm-hmm. your beliefs, and you know, what encourages and inspires you. And you know, that right there is like I said, it's a monumental moment. And for some people, I had another person on the show who he said the same thing. And he's a white guy, and he said that, you know, although he's known he was ready for a long time, he didn't know that other white people were ready. Mm. That's what made it so big to him. And he said that was why it's most significant to him, because to him it showed, you know, a major change in the thought process of how he thought about other people who looked like him.
Yeah. And wow.
I agree. And I was like, I've never thought of that. I've never thought of that mm-hmm. perspective, you know. And like I said,
it's the same event, but different perspective. Different
perspective, yes.
Wow. Yeah, no, I would have not, you know, thought to add that. So, but Black people too, were they ready? I know Black people today who still say, I don't want a Black doctor.
No, really?
I've had parents who gave me a hard time, Black parents, because I was a Black teacher.
Really? That's amazing.
Yes. I could not figure out for why this lady hated me so badly. She complained that I was young. I said, well, I'm not even the youngest teacher on this team. She complained that I was new. I said, I'm not the newest teacher on this team. So I don't know what you're saying. You know, why? Now when I see her, like her daughter is probably 2 years post high school. And when I see the daughter, I mean, I've always liked the little girl, but mom, now she all of a sudden likes me. And I'm like, you remember that time?
Wow. You know,
I'm holding a little bit of grudge, but yes, today there are people that say, oh, I don't want a Black doctor. I don't want a Black teacher.
Wow. That's what I have not
had. I have met them.
Wow.
And Black people too. Not, you know what I'm saying? Not any other culture of people.
That's crazy. Wow. I find that amazing. I've not had that experience. When I, in elementary school, people, and by no means am I, you know, a world-renowned teacher who knows everything that's going on, not like that, but, you know, a lot of parents wanted their kids in my class, specifically young Black kids, mm-hmm. young Black boys.
Yes.
And they said, we want our son in your class. And
because you're probably their first Black male teacher, maybe their first Black teacher. And most of us, I didn't have my first Black male teacher till 11th grade. So I got a Black male teacher in first grade and second grade. Like, that's a big time.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot. First day of school is always interesting. Look, meet and greet, you know, when they
yeah.
walk past the classroom and step in and ask, you know, where's Mrs. Johnson at? No. I'm here. It's uh-huh. Mrs. Johnson, and welcome to my class. And you know,
I bet their reaction is like, yes.
Some of them like, you don't look like a teacher. They got to figure me out first. They got to make sure that I'm real. Like, you know, yeah. I don't know. I've never had a lot.
Where's your badge? Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the kids say I've never had a boy teacher before.
Oh.
I don't know about you.
A boy teacher. That's cute. Yeah.
That's okay. We have a great time in the classroom.
When did you have your first Black male teacher? What grade?
High school, PE.
Yeah. Wow.
I don't, outside of PE, I don't believe I've had a black male teacher. Nope. I might come back at another podcast and say that I'm wrong, but I can't.
So then you became your first black male teacher.
Yep. I never thought about that. I can remember all my elementary school teachers. I had my computer science teacher, eighth grade, it was a black woman. I had, I went to an after school program where we had a black teacher.
Mm-hmm.
High school.
But look how you have to think about, like, you are going back through the years.
Yeah, it's a, outside of PE, I don't think I've
been. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, which, you know, all the, you know, the black males that I had in my life were coaches, which is why I also coached too. You know,
they
were.
Yeah. Too.
So.
Yeah, my first black male teacher in 11th grade was an African American history teacher.
How do I get that job?
And I know. And I think he coached football or something, but, you know, I wasn't interested in that. But having he might have been the only one at the high school, too.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Who is the most influential person in your life and why?
Gosh. I didn't realize it, but I guess I would say my grandmother. She just passed away in January.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And I guess I didn't realize that she was such a humble person and so meek. And I feel like I'm like her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably closer to my grandmother than anybody else in my family. That's my siblings, my cousins, my mama, because she had the morals and the values that I aspired. So I guess I would say in shaping me, however, like, she wasn't very driven, you know, to, like, she never got a license, she never drove a car. So, you know, that might have come from her too, because she never learned to read or write.
Mm.
And because she didn't, I did, you know. She was in hospice and on her deathbed, and she was just holding on. She stayed because she forgot how to eat. So she held on without food or drink for 10 days. So Mom, you know, we were finally like, go in there, close the door, air your grievances, say, you know, whatever it is that you need to say to her so that she can let go. And when it was my turn, I was able to say, like, I went to college and I made you proud.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just said, you did. And, you know, she didn't remember. But I didn't have anything. I'm sorry for disappointing you. I'm sorry for this I did and that I did. I didn't have any of that. So, you know, so I would say my grandmother.
That's amazing. And I asked that question to everybody, like the last three questions I asked to everybody in the podcast, because it's so important to find out, you know, what helped shape you, you know. And most of my guests on the podcast are black women.
Mm-hmm.
They have that same answer. They have the person in life who, you know, really teaches them how to be a strong black woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them come to the realization when you ask them about it.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Some of them know from, you know, from the get-go, like, it was this person and that's why.
It's hindsight, because, like I said, growing up, I didn't have anybody that I aspired to be like. I had to create that person. But now as I reflect, I'm like, I was really close. I mean, I was where my grandma was, I was there. And we were going to church for 6 hours. I was in church for 6 hours because that's where my grandma was. If grandma was going to the market, I was going to the market. So I never had a chance to get close to my cousins and my brother because they were, you know, playing or doing what they do, and I was with my grandma. So I had a lot of naysayers. So I think a lot of my inspiration was to prove people wrong too.
Okay. I agree with that.
So that drove me for a long time, and it drove me until I got to a place where I'm like, wait a minute, I've spent so many years trying not to be who they want me to be, that I don't know who I am, you know. So that was a whole yes, another podcast.
And that's one thing that, you know, I've learned from doing this podcast is that, you know, things that we talk about, you know, it brings up things that, you know, maybe we haven't thought about in a long time, or maybe we never thought about it. We want to expand on that. You know, doing my research and going through all this, you know, I learned about Dr. Valerie Thomas, but then yeah. I learned about, you know, there was one other female student in her class that graduated with her at Morgan State. I want to know who that is. I want to.
Yes, because it was two.
It was. And I want to expand, yes. And I want to know what she did. And, you know, and that's the great part about Black history. You know, in school, it may seem limited. It may seem direct, but it is huge. It is expansive. It is deep.
You really have to search. It's not readily available.
I agree. Like
this other person. You have to dig it up. I wonder if she worked with Katherine Johnson.
I wondered about that too. And one thing I said I was going to do, and I didn't, this is me being a bad host, is I was going to look up the timeline to see if they matched. And I haven't done that, but I can promise you that podcast is coming with for Katherine Johnson. Mm-hmm. It's going to be with a teacher that teaches engineering and physics.
Oh, wow. So, nice.
Yes.
That will not be me. I might come in and I just want to spectate just so I can, you know.
Yes. Yeah, so she'll be on
one note or something.
But that is coming. Is there anything you would want to add?
I just thank you for including me. I really appreciate, you know, learning about, you know, I don't, you know, this, and maybe others don't, but I went through this whole Black History Month project, and where I dressed up as a famous person in Black history for every day of the month in February. And with you bringing people like Valerie Thomas to light, you know, I'm starting my list early. So that I can, you know, when school starts back, not even in February, but when school starts back, I can go ahead and have these people and have my ideas ready. So no, this is really good.
So
I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. I thank you for being with us today. If you would like to reach out to us and give us ideas for the podcast, tell us ways we can improve, make a correction in the research, please feel free to email us at bhshortstories@gmail.com. That's B as in Black, H as in history, and short stories, plural. We also have a Short Stories of Black History Twitter you can look us up on. And one more thing before we go, we do a thing called Big Facts of the podcast. So Big Facts, and that, you know, it's kind of like real things that, you know, you may not know about, but Morgan State, the HBCU, where Dr. Valerie Thomas graduated from, specializes in research science. They specialize in organic chemistry, analytical chemistry, physical chemistry, inorganic chemistry, electrochemistry, polymer and materials chemistry, medical biotechnology, bioenvironmental chemistry, and theoretical and computational chemistry. So, all those young scientists, chemists out there looking for a place, Morgan State got your back. So I'll definitely encourage that. But thank you for joining us today. See you next time.